From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside SF.
Coming up, we'll learn about the challenges of getting to school in San Francisco.
They've already told us that they're planning on cutting this school bus. There's not going to be this school bus by May of this year.
Then, when there's something buzzing outside your house, who are you going to call? This lady.
Bees flying and pooping all over my room. And they poop yellow and it's hard to get off.
And we discover San Francisco Goth.
It was home for the dispossessed, the oppressed, the truly absurd in mind and appearance, those who didn't give a damn and just wanted to dance.
That and more today on Cross Currents. If you've lived in San Francisco long enough, you might have noticed that there are fewer and fewer yellow school buses crisscrossing the city. State budget cuts have forced the school district to cut bus services to 98% of high school students. Only five middle schools still get busing. Even elementary schools have been losing service, and deeper cuts are promised for next year. As a result, Muni has become the primary mode of transportation for most students. But the routes aren't always direct. Many students take two or three buses. Some have to leave their homes by 6:30 a.m. to get to school by 8. And others sometimes can't make it to school at all because they can't afford the fare. Mayor Ed Lee has said he's working to reduce transportation costs for students. In the meantime, reporter Kyung Jin Lee has more on how the students and the schools are coping.
At 7:30 on a chilly Wednesday morning, Manuela Esteva is bustling around her house, getting her two kids ready for school.
So they've already told us that they're planning on cutting this school bus. There's not going to be this school bus by May of this year.
Esteva's children are age 6 and 10. They attend Gordon Lau Elementary School in Chinatown. And right now, there's a yellow school bus that takes them directly there from Esteva's home in the Mission.
The advantage to taking the school bus is that I can drop off my daughters at 7:40. They'll get there before classes start, and it's free.
But when the yellow bus disappears, she'll have to go with them to school. It's a 40-minute trip on two Muni buses, if she times it right. And it'll cost her $7 every day, quite a lot for a single mom.
Another disadvantage to taking the MTA bus is that I have to go with them, and so I have to return back to my job, and I lose time in doing my work.
It's a problem the school district is aware of.
We now have 38 buses that are transporting students this year, and next year we're looking at having 25 buses.
That's San Francisco Unified School District spokeswoman, Gentle Blythe. She says almost 1,000 students lost school bus services this year, and next year's cuts will dig even deeper. The district expects to lose more than 30% of its transportation funding. The district already has some idea of what can happen when school buses disappear. For the past 4 years, most San Francisco high school students haven't had them. Only special needs students get access to buses.
Bye. Bye.
Devorier King is a junior at John O'Connell High School in the Mission. He says he sometimes ends up spending 2.5 hours each day on public transit.
Well, my daily commute is kind of like busy because I'm coming from Treasure Island and with Muni, they don't have enough buses to come out there. So I missed that bus. I missed 30 minutes of my school, and so with that being said, I'm truant because of it, and it's affecting my grades.
Downtown high school principal Mark Alvarado says it's often hard for students to pay for Muni. He gets hit up for bus fare several times a day.
Personally, I'll tell you how much I spent this week. I spent $6 so far.
And we're Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Alvarado says another concern is safety. While most of his students get to school and back safely, he's also dealt with serious incidents in the past.
The bus is often a violent place, and the students who are concerned with taking the bus, it's been hard for a few years.
The violent crime on Muni has dropped recently. Just last week, a teenager was shot while riding a Muni bus in the middle of the afternoon.
We've had fatalities. We've had serious injuries. We, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens. So the danger is real.
The school district is seeking workarounds. It set up programs to encourage group walking where possible, as well as bike to school days and a rideshare website for parents. Some city officials are also trying to improve the situation. Along with several community organizations, San Francisco Supervisor David Campos has been calling for free muni passes for all youth between the ages of 5 and 17. He says the program would serve several purposes.
For the public transit system in San Francisco to be sustained long term, you need to actually make sure that people actually ride muni, and you need to instill that, especially in young people. We're also making an investment in education. We believe that kids should go to school and should not be that not being able to afford to pay for public transit should get in the way of them going to school.
Campos estimates that the proposed two-year pilot will cost about $17.5 million. An alternative plan currently on the table calls for a $5 monthly youth pass. O'Connell High School student Devorier King says he hopes the free youth pass is implemented.
It would be easier for me to wake up in the morning myself, knowing that I don't have to, like, burn money out of my pocket just to go to school.
In the meantime, parent Manuela Esteva says she and her neighbors are working together to figure out how to get their kids to school.
We need to organize among our communities because we can support each other as neighbors as well. I'm going to have to take my children to school, but so are a lot of the families that live around me, so we can support each other by having maybe a day where one of us takes a group of children and we split it up that way.
Muni's board of directors will vote on the free youth pass April 3rd. Even if it passes, it might be months before the program's fully implemented. Until then, San Francisco youth and their families will have to keep digging in their pockets to get to school. For Cross Currents, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
How do you get your kids to school? Are school buses an issue where you live? Call our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now to some good economic news. Things are picking up in the employment market. The Labor Department announced today that weekly unemployment claims nationwide have dropped by 5,000, and the national unemployment rate is now 8.3%. That's the lowest in 4 years. In California, the jobless rate stands at 10.9%, down from 12.1% a year ago. And while the job market is picking up, many workers are finding themselves underemployed in the new economy. That includes Bay Area journalist Christopher Cook, who recently wrote about his own struggles to make ends meet for Salon Magazine. He shares his thoughts in this commentary.
My benefits counselor is a vigorous man who speaks like a machine gun. He leads me to a numbered booth and a long row of numbered booths. I take my seat across from him. ID, Social Security card? I hand him a stack of materials proving it's me sitting here. He asks me rat-a-tat-tat, unemployed, self-employed, how much per month? I'm self-employed, I tell him. Pay is very inconsistent, $750 or $800 a month. You have pay stubs? I show him a few check receipts from a folder. $450 here, $100 there. Welcome to the writer's life in America today. How much are your bills? I tally them up. $770 a month for rent, $40 for cell phone, $25 for utilities. That's over $800 right there. He looks at me. How are you surviving? Your rent is higher than your income? Savings, I tell him. For the past few years, as a mid-career journalist and author, I've buttressed my $15,000 or less a year with some money my grandmother left me. All told, I live on about $20,000, not much for big city living. I work my butt off 40 hours a week, but that little nest egg is almost gone. I'm hardly alone. According to the USDA, 46.3 million Americans depend on food stamps to survive. It's a historic high due to recession and population growth. Roughly 1 in 6 Americans do not have reliable access to food, 1 in 5 children. Nearly half the country is poor or low income. The vast underbelly of America is economically and nutritionally underfed. I call myself frayed white collar, part of the privileged poor. I have a college degree, a career, and an economic rainbow of middle class, working class, and more privileged friends. Most of us are hard pressed. My teacher friends make about $60,000 a year, but they're perpetually broke, eking across each month's finish line thanks to credit cards. The caseworker thrusts some papers in front of me. Sign. I do. He asks, "Getting unemployment now? Been on food stamps before?" "No, no unemployment," I tell him. "As a freelancer, I don't qualify. This is my first time on food stamps, except for when I was a kid. I grew up on food stamps. In the 1980s, while Ronald Reagan was attacking welfare queens, my single mother and I relied on food stamps for years, even when she worked at a health food store in Boston. We muddled through with her poverty wages, food stamp booklets, and sometimes slightly bruised but edible produce the store couldn't sell. I don't recall feeling ashamed about being poor. Those food stamp coupons seemed like Monopoly play money, and they kept us going. But now I'm 44, single, nobody to feed other than myself. And as the caseworker signs the final papers, I feel defeated. How have I fallen back to where I was when I was a food stamp Head Start kid, getting, yes, free lunches? I never bought the American narrative of progress and opportunity, yet somehow I feel like a flunky for not holding up my end of the bargain. The caseworker checks a few boxes, and with that, I'm certified for 12 months of benefits. With my Golden State Advantage benefits card in hand, I move quickly from shame to guilt. Why? I pay taxes, even if not very much on my poverty-level income, nearly the same rate as America's multimillionaires do. Oh yes, of course, this is Bootstraps America, land of free capitalistic opportunity. Public assistance has always carried the puritanical stink of stigma, as if the rich never got a helping hand from their families, their often inherited privileges. The fact is, these benefits keep people alive. They keep people eating, and they keep other people working by propping up food purchases. Food stamps are not the problem, nor are they the solution. They are a life raft that barely keeps people afloat, while America's corporations and the rich siphon profits away from the public treasury and avoid taxes, all while blaming the poor for living off virtually nothing. I fit that latter profile, trying to survive as a San Francisco journalist, trying to survive in America's new economy, along with 46 million other hungry people.
That's Bay Area journalist Christopher Cook. You can find links to his work at our website. It's kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Food plays a multifaceted role in our lives. It nourishes us. It also heals us. Herbs and plant-based serums have been known to be therapeutic for centuries. And one food that's also one of nature's best elixirs for everything from soothing a sore throat to dressing a wound is...
sugar.
No.
Oh, honey, honey.
That's right. Honey. The sweet, thick, sticky liquid produced by our friends in nature, bees. Well, they're not always our friends. Imagine, for example, if there was a beehive on your front porch. That would be a problem. But it's a problem that Bay Area beekeeper Marina Shoup would gladly solve for you. You see, Shoup is a member of the San Francisco Beekeepers Association, and she's one of two women in the group who remove unwanted beehives. The process is known as extraction. Shoup told KALW's Stephen Short about the first time she had to answer a call for extraction. She ended up getting way more intimate with bees than ever before.
I would almost say it was mystical in that, I mean, we had to locate the hive. I mean, we kind of knew where they were. We could tell where they were coming into the wall. And then we actually got into the living room, kind of located a general area where they were. And Karen rubbed her hand, you know, in a horizontal line across some studs, you know, on the sheetrock inside the living room. And all of a sudden it went from room temperature to really warm. Because the bees keep the hive in the 90s, and they're behind the wall, and we could feel the heat through the sheetrock. It was great. And as we started to open up the wall, it was clear that there had been a previous hive, because there was old wax from before, and they were going to run out of room. So we just slowly, we had a bee vacuum, sucked them out, and cut away the wall, and we'd cut out pieces of comb that they had created in the wall that had brood. Had baby bees and eggs. So we basically took their whole hive in a box back to the city. We had 10 frames that we had rubber banded with brood and egg and pollen that they had already collected. We had a big bucket of honey, frames that just had comb honey. And we had a vacuum full of bees. This particular vacuum, they get sucked in a tube, just like a vacuum, but they get sucked into a cage that has screen on two sides, so they're not going to die. And we found the queen at the end of... She had fallen out of the wall, and she was on the ground. We almost threw her away. She was in the debris pile. Found her. She was huge. She was like a limousine, like an inch and a half. She was just this... The Hayward bees are rather large. And so the next morning... Oh, the crack-up is we didn't get back to the city until about 9 o'clock at night. And it was cold and blustery, and I didn't want to marry the three components, my frames, all the bees, and the queen, which was in a Tupperware with some attendants. So they spent the night in my bedroom. I had the whole beehive in my bedroom all night because it's going to be warmer than outside. And I want to keep the brood warm because it'll kill it otherwise. So I get up about 7:30, take a shower, and between taking a shower... And getting out of the shower, with the 4 minutes, they started escaping through the screen door I'd put on the vacuum cleaner, and I had about 200 bees in my bedroom. And I wanted to wait until it was a little warmer to marry the components outside, put them in a box, and I had to do it then. So I had bees flying and pooping all over my room. And they poop yellow, and it's hard to get off. It just was hilarious. It was just hilarious. But it was really interesting sleeping with them because they don't sleep. And so there was a slight humming all night long. And as soon as the sun hit my windows, you know, the volume went up. And it was actually quite magical.
We'd like to hear your encounters with nature. Facebook us at KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. This is Cross Currents. And now it's time to meet your neighbors.
I like my neighbors. I like my neighbors. I like them a lot.
KALW's Nina Morente is a bit new to San Francisco, but there's one place in the city where she feels at home. On some Monday nights, she'll go out to the DNA Lounge in the Soma District to revel in the subculture known to most outsiders as goth. In this segment of our series, Meet Your Neighbors, she brings us into the night spot called Death Guild, which some consider to be the longest-running goth club in the country.
A group of people dressed in black and wearing platform boots are smoking cigarettes near the corner of 11th and Harrison. For someone just passing by, it could be an intimidating scene. But they're not causing trouble. They're actually standing outside what is quite possibly the most tolerant and accepting nightclub in San Francisco.
We get people in business suits. We get people in, preppy clothes. We get people in gothic clothes. We get people in fetish clothes. It's basically... Anything you can dream of, it comes here.
Brian Von Reber checks coats at Death Guild and says he's been here since its very first night in 1992. The club started as a showcase for alternative music, But now the genres can loosely be described as goth, industrial, noise, and weird stuff. For Von Reber and many others, Death Guild is a family where, if you can find your groove, you definitely belong, especially if you're a person who isn't used to fitting in.
The people that have been coming for a long time, we're all sort of broken machines in to varying degrees, and we can relate to each other. I mean, some of us are slightly broken, some of us are really broken, but we come here and we don't feel quite as broken. We see people that we know and we like, or we meet new people and we hear music that we like, and we can dance and sort of forget about everything that made us broken.
When you walk into the DNA Lounge, you'll notice that it's dark, almost foggy. The music is loud and it's pulsing. It could seem chaotic, but it feels actually safe. Guys aren't constantly hitting on girls, and everybody seems to have an inherent sense of space. People dance on a stage, and a suspended balcony surrounds the perimeter. The vibe creates a sort of collective energy. People dance with finesse and grace at Death Guild. It's cathartic, but honestly, it takes a while to get used to. Colin Barton is a regular at Death Guild.
There's two major types of music that get played here. Classic goth, which is everything from 80s to modern, also often called swirly goth, and industrial, which is aggressive, pounding, electronic music. I'm mainly an industrial dancer, so some people like to swirl around in outfits from the 80s to the swirly goth, and some people like to wear more military and industrial-inspired outfits and stomp around, and I'm one of those.
So that's actually a way of dancing, being swirly and stompy.
Well, these terms have very practical purposes. If you look at the people on stage, some will be, like, swirling back and forth, and some will be stomping around. And, of course, there's quite a bit more nuanced each than that, but to a casual observer, they look exactly like what they sound like.
It sounds unnerving at first, but really, the people at Death Guild go out of their way to connect with both regulars and newcomers. Nobody at the club acts dismissive, and that's possibly because the people who go to Death Guild aren't normal clubgoers. Some are shy, some are misanthropic, and many liken themselves to being nonconformist. For them, this is the only place where they can be assured to talk with other people in a friendly environment. One of the guys creating the mood here is DJ Decay, or DK, a tall and broad figure with a partially shaved head and red-colored braids cascading down his back. He wears black boots and a black sweater, and usually you'll see him jumping back and forth between the ticket booth and the main stage.
My name is David King. I am the founder and promoter and DJ for Death Guild, one of several DJs for Death Guild. I am also the night manager for DNA Lounge, so I'm pretty much here anytime we're open. When you love someone.
King bought the club in 1992. He says there's an ongoing debate with the place in London over which is the oldest goth industrial club in the world.
There's been debate that the Slimelight has been going longer than Death Guild has, but as far as having a cohesive night that has been consistent, on a weekly basis throughout the years, I think Death Guild has them beat.
The way King runs it, the environment is intentionally low-key, and he doesn't care for stereotypical labels.
So many names that people have come up for to isolate themselves or separate themselves from everybody else. I look at Death Guild as something that encompasses anything that is alternative.
In fact, King has put his philosophy down on paper, writing an unfinished history of Death Guild.
It was home for the dispossessed, the oppressed, the truly absurd in mind and appearance, those who didn't give a damn and just wanted to dance, gothic, industrial, and alternative 80s all night, or to those who wanted to drink all night to forget, and even some who wanted to remember. We had everyone from the subcultures represented. It was a sanctuary to those who sought such.
The black-clad smokers out front of the DNA Lounge are part of a 20-year-long anti-authoritarian tradition at Death Guild. But don't let the dark goth atmosphere throw you. This is a club that's for everyone. In San Francisco, I'm Nina Morente for Cross Currents.
You can hear more Meet Your Neighbors segments online at KALW.org. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Sarah Bernard, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jordan Katz, Casey Miner, Nina Morente, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and David Waldorf. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. This is the Berklee High School Jazz Band. First, they walk away from this year's Folsom Jazz Festival with a first-place win. Then, they qualify for the Next Generation Orchestra at this year's Monterey Jazz Festival. And you can hear them on Monday when they have a gig at Yoshi's in Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.